Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Our topic on this edition of the program is Growing Anarchy in Libya as Rival Islamist Militias Vie for Supremacy. Our guest, William Lawrence, currently a visiting professor of politics and international affairs at George Washington University here in Washington. An expert on North Africa, William is also Middle East and North Africa director at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. Previous, William served as director of the North Africa Project at the International Crisis Group, or ICG. That's a non-governmental organization dedicated to preventing and resolving deadly conflict worldwide. And prior to joining ICG, William Lawrence served in a number of senior advisory positions at the U.S. Department of State. We'll talk with William Lawrence about the current chaos engulfing Libya and to what extent the international community, including the UN Security Council, may have to increasingly become involved in disarming the warring factions. Currently, two military coalitions are competing for government control. Their power struggles have almost paralyzed the country, leaving it with two de facto parliaments and two prime ministers. On August 18th and 23rd, unidentified aircraft, which later turned out to have been based in Egypt, but flown by pilots from the United Arab Emirates, or UAE, bombed targets in Tripoli. But the victors were those whose positions had been targeted by the mystery warplanes, an alliance of militias, chief among them units from the prosperous port city of Misrata, which joined Islamists, Berbers, and other fighters drawn from several smaller towns on Libya's western flank. They defeated militiamen from the more conservative western mountain town of Zinten, who had held the city's airport since Gaddafi fell in 2011. Many analysts say that Libya now combines all the ingredients, including meddling foreigners, for a protracted civil war. Well, we'll talk with William Lawrence about all of this and much more. William Lawrence, welcome to the program.
Hello.
And I'm delighted, as always, to welcome my colleague, Mohammed Elshenawi.
Thank you.
William Lawrence, Bill, as we call you here, bring us up to date. Was there a particular precipitating event to which you can point that accounts for so much chaos currently in Libya, which looked like a promising prospect after the Arab Spring sort of turned deadly, one might say, throughout the Middle East? Talk about how we got to this point.
Well, one precipitating moment was what we call the Valentine's Day coup, not coup, when General Haftar, a former general under Gaddafi, who was estranged and spent a couple of decades here in Falls Church, Virginia, he declared that he was going to take on the Libyan government. So for a while, we were talking about a renegade general threatening renegade militias, but nothing happened. And then finally in May, Haftar gathered several thousand fighters, including some former Gaddafi elements, and started this campaign, which was well-intentioned. It was well-intentioned because there'd been a string of assassinations against police chiefs, security personnel, civil society activists, and politicians in the key city of Benghazi. And so Haftar garnered a lot of popular support by saying, I'm going to clean things up. Then what happened is the very act of whacking these militias and conflating all Islamists, whether moderate or extreme, and anyone allied with the Islamists as a threat to the Libyan state. He actually forced the other side to coalesce and become a stronger alliance. That alliance is now beating Haftar's forces and their allies. So many, including a lot of the regional powers, would like to see this as a secularist versus Islamist conflict. But it not more than anything else, Haftar's action made it that way. But that's the problem now, because the real fight is between, as you mentioned in your setup, between the Zintanis and the Misratans, neither of which are very secular or Islamist, and who are really fighting over ports of entry and control of resources and have allied themselves, you know, within Libya and beyond, really in a struggle over resources that has little to do with ideology.
Let me let Mohammed ask a question.
Bill, Libya's ambassador to Egypt, Mohammed Jibril, called for an international intervention, saying Libya is currently unable to protect its institutions or airports or oil fields. Is there any appetite for another international coalition in Libya?
For 3 years, I've been calling for international boots on the ground, and often I was the only person in the room calling for it. One of the reasons is Libyans convinced themselves that they themselves and no one else in Libya would accept an international intervention. Libya does need, I think, an international stabilization force to focus at first on protecting the parliament. Right now, the parliament is on a Greek car ferry off the Tobruk coast. Think about that for a minute. That's where the parliament is right now. And so to protect the parliament in its proper city, to protect key ministries, to protect the oil fields, which are the lifeline for the Libyan economy, and to protect water and electricity supplies to the key cities. That could be done with a few thousand international troops. Instead, what we have is international powers that have interests in Libya calling for an international intervention. So, for example, you had this recent meeting in Cairo with the Algerians and Chad and the Sudanese calling for an intervention, except they're lining up, as with the setup he mentioned of UAE, with one side in this conflict. And that could have a very nefarious, polarizing impact. What we really need right now is an internationally encouraged and monitored ceasefire, a de-escalation in Libya, and an inclusive political negotiation that demonstrates to people on the Islamist side of the ledger who lost the elections last June.
That is right.
You know, that they will have a place in this new Libyan parliament and don't have to hang on to the vestigial old parliament to have a say in Libyan politics.
That's a very good point, Bill. So are there any voices calling for such an intervention, a much more neutral intervention? It's hard to believe because there are so many crises around the world, whether it's Ukraine, whether the so-called Islamist State and trying to combat them in Syria and Iraq. Is Libya sort of becoming a victim of so much going on in the world and being neglected as a result?
Absolutely. I mean, right now, my biggest concern in terms of neglect is Tunisia, because the Tunisian transition is very fragile. And if Tunisia fails, that's bad for everyone. But the second most important neglected story in the MENA region right now, in my opinion, is Libya. When I used to be a diplomat, and we often used to look for low-hanging fruit. Compared to Iraq and Syria, Libya's low-hanging fruit. Again, with a few thousand international troops, you could go in and stabilize this thing quite quickly against handfuls of militias. You do have upwards of 1,600 militias in Libya, but more than 1,500 of those are pro-government, pro-revolution. They're not the problem. So we're talking about, you know, a small number of militias that are really causing the problems. Compared to Iraq and Syria, Libya is a cakewalk.
Okay, but talking about militias and Islamist influence in a nefarious way, talk about, you know, the Islamists in Libya, their relationship with Al-Qaeda groups, and do any groups identify with or sympathize with the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant?
Absolutely. As I said in my testimony before the House of Representatives last November, the biggest problem in North Africa right now is Syria. And North Africa has been sending thousands and thousands of fighters from Libya, from Tunisia, from across North Africa to fight in Syria. So there's a direct connection between Libyans fighting in Syria and now Iraq and Libyans coming back from Syria and now Iraq to fight in Libya and sympathies. You even have a plethora of new caliphates, right? We have two caliphates in Syria, one in Iraq, one in Nigeria, and a caliphate in Derna. So that, you know, there's sort of messaging connections and sympathy between all these various radical groups. But the vast majority of Libyans aren't Islamist. The vast majority of Libyan militias aren't Islamist. And this narrative of secular versus Islamist, which is often picked up in the U.S. media, even in the testimony I saw this week in the U.S. Congress, which was very much polarized about who are the good guys and who are the bad guys in Libya, is very unhelpful. Libyans are quite conservative, but they're not very sympathetic with ISIL, except for a certain percentage, you know, these young fighters that go out. And don't forget, the young fighters from all over North Africa, including Libya, went to fight Assad. And then, unfortunately, they've been swept up in this whole other project in Iraq, which is not why they went out there. But back to Libya, there are connections. The AQIM, of course, the longstanding al-Qaeda group, is crisscrossing Libyan territory. There are weapons flows. There are all kinds of concerns. But again, the vast majority of people fighting in Libya and nearly all of the weapons are Libyan. and the solution to this is Libyan. And the more we view Libya through this sort of crisis in MENA rubric or frame that pits Islamists against secularists in a zero-sum game, the less quickly we're going to get to an outcome of what is essentially, in Libya, fighting between municipalities over control of resources much more than anything else.
So do you expect the upcoming meeting of the General Assembly would respond to the French defense call for international intervention?
I'm not optimistic. There's also a meeting coming up in Spain in a week, and I'm not that optimistic about that right now. One of the problems at the UN is the UN Security Council and its own politics. And there's some indication, for example, that the Russians might be willing to go along with something more robust on Libya if there were concessions on Ukraine. Concessions they're not going to get anytime soon. And so the UN, for that and other reasons, has, despite the fact that the UN still has a lot of credibility among Libyans, and the U.S. has a lot of credibility among Libyans, more than perhaps any other country in the MENA region, we still have a UN that's unable to take the leadership role Libyans would like it to take. And so it's going to take a lot of diplomatic heavy lifting, and I don't think it'll be quick at the UN to get to the point that, for example, we're deploying Turkish and Canadian and Moroccan peacekeepers in Libya. And by the way, let me add another point. These meetings in Cairo by the neighbors are problematic in another way. When it comes to peacekeeping, don't have your neighbor doing the peacekeeping.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is William Lawrence. He's a visiting professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Mohammed El-Shanawi. He's senior Middle East reporter at the Voice of America. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. So if you have comments about this or future programs, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. You may also like and comment on our Facebook page at Carol Castiel, VOA, and also please follow me on Twitter. Here's a shout-out to a faithful listener, Ibrahim Oyekani from Nigeria. Thanks, Ibrahim. And now a question from Mohammed.
Will Egypt offer to train Libyan police and army units and also pledge to support the so-called legitimate representatives of the Libyan people? Would that mean Egypt is taking sides?
No, but Egypt is taking sides. That in and of itself is a good thing. And for example, the U.S. has offered to train the new general purpose force. I believe in Bulgaria was the last place they said, and they just signed the agreement a few weeks ago to move forward on the GPF. Any training is good. And certainly the Egyptians have skills that are transferable to Libyans. But Egypt is taking side. Egypt's military, of course, took over last year in a takeover that is a clear indication of taking sides in these sort of civilizational conflicts that we're talking about. General Haftar in Libya has called on the Egyptians to intervene more. There's, of course, this recent strike that Carol was talking about. And so Egypt is not neutral. And so the political optics of having Egypt taking a lead role is an indication that Libya has gone one way or another in terms of resolving its dispute. And I just don't think you're going to have a lot of social peace or peace in general in Libya if one side or the other is winning. That said, Egypt has been attacked on its western border. Egypt is fighting a major struggle in the Sinai right now. And Egypt has its own domestic turmoil over the last year. And so I don't think Egypt's going to meddle for meddling's sake. I think a lot of Egypt's actions and determinations have a lot to do with Egypt's own domestic stability. Egypt needs Libya to stabilize. And I think Egypt believes if it has to do it, it will do it. So that's an extra reason that more international countries not bordering Libya have to step up and fill this void, which Egypt has correctly identified.
But even Turkey and Qatar cannot get involved because they are supporting the Islamists.
I think that's true. So unless, for example, if you have UAE on one side of this and Qatar on the other, and they were both involved, if you're picking one country or the other, then you have a problem. Same thing with the Turks.
Did I hear you say that the United States is popular in Libya?
Yes.
They are?
Yes.
And can they or should they be doing more?
Well, there's very little appetite for U.S. boots on the ground in the United States.
Right, but short of boots on the ground.
Yeah, and there's very little appetite in the region for American troops on the ground because of the experience of Iraq. So U.S. troops in Libya could be a magnet for anti-American forces coming in from neighboring countries.
Well, of course, but again, not the troops on the ground, but more training.
There needs to be U.S. leadership.
Or more, exactly, leadership.
Absolutely.
And convening or impressing upon the United Nations for a neutral force.
And this
force.
Was a lot of what the debate this week in the U.S. Congress at the Libya hearing was about, what type of leadership role the U.S. Can take, should take. Unfortunately, the Republicans are on both sides of this issue. They're sort of more interventionist Republicans and anti-interventionist Republicans.
Yes.
Same thing on the Democratic side. You kind of have sort of calls for leadership, but then when you start defining what policies you need, you started a conversation on the other side of the aisle as well. So Americans aren't clear about what kind of role they want to play in this post-imperial world where everyone seems to want the U.S., but when the U.S. is on their side. And so it's a tricky thing, but there's no question that this is a moment where the U.S. could do a lot in relatively short order if it took a leading role, and it has credibility in Libya.
And of course, it took a leading role when it helped to defeat Gaddafi with that international force, a UN and Arab League-backed force to protect those in Benghazi. To what extent, William, do you think something went awry? Maybe it was a good idea and well done, but do you think perhaps having abandoned, in a sense, Libya in the aftermath of that and allowing all of these militias to get access to the arms that are now flooding the area and even, you know, the region in Mali and so forth, do you think there was neglect, and can we, you know, fault the lack of follow-up for what is going on today to some extent?
Yes, although you can't predict the future, of course. But there's no question that the U.S. intervened, despite all the cacophony you hear about the real aims of it, on positive grounds, on humanitarian grounds. There was the slaughter of civilians, which had already begun. The troops were already moving on Benghazi. There was a massacre in Zawiya and massacre in Tripoli that got very little press attention, that were hundreds of people and an indication of further bloodshed. So there's no question that the U.S. Intervened, not unlike the recent defense of the Kurds in northern Iraq, on a positive humanitarian ground, and then we had to come up with a strategy about how to fix the problem because, you know, these quick interventions and from the air, there's only so much you can do. The U.S. hasn't gotten good at it yet. There's a lot of arguments not to intervene at all. But the prospect of another slaughter in Libya like we were facing with Gaddafi, or a slaughter of the Kurds in northern Iraq like we were facing with ISIS, you can't stomach that either. So what we're going to need is stronger allies and, may I say it, more democratic allies. Mark Lynch had a great piece this week, Abu Aardvark, the blogger.
Right, Mark, he's a professor.
Professor at GW, and he was talking about counterterrorism with autocrats. And here we are starting up again in Iraq and Syria, but also in contemplating it in Libya, of another campaign against terrorists allied with autocratic regimes, which will be both security-wise, but also politically repressive when they come back in and take over territory. This is why everyone's talking about a political deal in Libya, an inclusive political deal where everyone has a seat at the table, following whatever happens. And one side or the other coming in to clean things up is not a positive thing. Think about the framing for a minute, too. On the Islamist side of the ledger in Libya, they're looking at the Haftar and allied forces as the Gaddafi regime trying to come back. And on the Haftar side of the ledger, they're seeing this as an Islamist Iran-style takeover of Libya.
Which, of course,
But
that is not true.
Yeah, neither of those framings is true, but it's part of it. And the longer this goes and the more people that die, the more you could face a Lebanon-style. People keep talking about a failed state. I'm not worried about a failed state in Libya as much as I'm worried about a 20-year Lebanese-style civil war that just goes on and on and on. We need to stop this as soon as possible and not by taking sides.
But with the current polarization between the two warring factions, is it possible at all that the stalemate in Libya could lead to a partitioning in the future?
Absolutely. And this has been the great threat all along, as I've said in my writings and others have said. You could have a partitioning in Libya. Until the last 4 months, that wasn't likely because you were really talking about fiefdoms. If you were going to have a participating, it was almost municipal-based militias and local power. And not on a tribal basis for the most part, mostly on a municipality basis, geography basis. Now, because of the Haftar action, which again I said was welcome but made things worse, you could contemplate now Libya divided in half. But think about that for a minute. Right now, the Zintanis, right, control the area west of Tripoli, right? Mm-hmm. They control the airport in Benghazi. They control Tobruk, right? And other areas in a patchwork quilt. And then the other side, right, they control most of Tripoli, right? Most of Benghazi, Derna, where there's the new caliphate, and scattered other places. So you're not talking about two sides with a clear border. You're talking about a patchwork quilt of former municipal control that's now, through a set of complicated alliances, being made into two sides. How that shakes out could get quite ugly. And the faster we de-escalate from a two sides in this conflict frame, the more likely that we can escape a protracted war and have a political solution with some sustainability.
So what's the most likely scenario you can anticipate in Libya in the coming year?
Positive or negative?
Both.
Well, I think the most likely scenario, positive or negative, is that we will continue to have fighting and peacemaking intermittently the same way we've had over the last 3 years. The problem is now with more weapons coming in and these new alliances, the scale and the duration tends to get longer. So instead of a 4-day conflict, which was typical from 2011, 2013, now you might have a 40-day conflict and then some kind of ceasefire. This is really bad for Libya. You may have noticed along the way that we had over a year now of almost no oil production in Libya. We were down to 10% of oil production. Wow. Now it's rumored we're back up to half. I don't quite believe that. And oil's become a weapon in this conflict. Libya does have money in the bank, which they're not really spending apparently, but that's not going to last forever. And even the U.S. isn't operating on IOUs with Libya. It's one of the reasons the training of the General Purpose Force hasn't started, because the Libyans haven't ponied up the money for the training yet. And there was a discussion this week in Congress about who's going to pay for it. And I found that conversation very troubling, because if we're worried about a little bit of training that will stabilize an entire country, which is a major energy resource for the whole global market, we shouldn't be worried about a little bit of money spent on training here or there. But this is how things are in Washington. Mm. So I am not optimistic for this year. But the main thing right now is the less fighting, the better. There are logics of violence. As they say in Arabic, al-unf yunadi ila al-unf, right? The violence begets violence. Right. It's a biblical expression too. And so the more people that get killed and they get die, the more martyrs you have, family members who are angry, who see things in zero-sum terms. And the civil war everyone thought would never happen in Libya becomes more and more likely.
Is there any disarming of the militias taking place?
No, and it won't happen. You know, they've tried. I think there's been at least 30 or 40 arms rendering campaigns. And the joke used to be, if you've got four tanks behind the house, you know, drive one down to them. In fact, the opposite's been going on. The militias oversold into arms black markets, and they started buying back the weapons that had traveled towards Chad and Mali and Niger, because they'd oversold and realized that they need their weapons longer. Why? Because with no functioning police and no functioning army in Libya, the militias have to defend the municipalities. As I was saying, this 90% of militias who are either working for the government or allied with the government in trying to keep the country stable, notwithstanding this fighting between the alliances that I'm talking about. And so it's quite clear that any call for rendering arms is going to fall on deaf ears until you have the type of political stability you need to have the institutional backing for army and police that allow people to turn in their weapons.
Well, just like when Gaddafi was overthrown with the U.S.-led effort, and the French were very involved. What about the French role and Europe's role, perhaps because they're closer to Libya? Are they stepping up to the plate in any way? And with the United States now, you know, mired in trying to combat the ISIL threat?
They'd like to, but I think the main problem is whether or not there's a problem of political will, and I'm not so sure there's a problem of political will, there's a problem of capacity in Europe. Americans spend huge amounts of money on defense for all kinds of reasons. And because of that, I think what U.S. arms spending equals the next 50 countries, you know. And so the U.S. becomes the world policeman because they spend money on arms. I mean, the Germans for a long time didn't have an army. The French have their economic crisis, which affected things. And the French have a much bigger army than the Brits do, or bigger in certain ways. So you have a Europe that, wants U.S. leadership in stabilizing its own backyard. So this idea that somehow we can leave North Africa or the Sahel to the Europeans doesn't reflect realities in Europe. That said, when you hear about alliances of, you know, 114 countries willing to work on Syria, 40 countries allied to work on ISIS, or I think we're talking about a couple dozen countries willing to work on Libya, that's a good thing, because it's never good for a regional or global power to act unilaterally in one of these countries. You have to have coalitions, whether or not you have a UN Security Council mandate, doing these things so that the international community and the domestic community feels that this is not an interested party intervening in their country.
Well, let's hope that we'll see a more neutral coalition or the United Nations. But I want to pick up on something before we close, William Lawrence, that you alluded to, and that is Tunisia, the impact of this chaos on Tunisia, because you talked about Tunisia also being fragile and needing help now before it also perhaps descends into chaos. Talk about the consequences of this instability in Libya on Tunisia.
I think we're talking about as many as 800,000, up to a million Libyans in Tunisia. We have 250,000 displaced Libyans right now on the move from the fighting in the last 4 months. So we do have a humanitarian crisis. They have a huge impact on Tunisia's economy, on Tunisia's social life, and on the threats. When Tunisian President Marzouki was here for the Africa Summit in early August, he admitted having once said politics was the biggest problem in Tunisia, and then a year later said that economics is the biggest problem in Tunisia, he's now saying that security is the biggest problem in Tunisia, and that he and the Nahda party, when they were in power, and others underestimated the security threats. Tunisia is very, very worried about the security impacts on Tunisia of the Libya crisis, and they do not feel that they are well empowered in terms of their own army and police. They were here looking for helicopters and night vision goggles and counterterrorism equipment. They're getting ready for the worst case in Libya, and they're very concerned.
Well, another reason why the international community must not let the instability in Libya fester any longer. William Lawrence is a Middle East and North Africa expert, and he's a political science and international affairs professor at George Washington University. Bill Lawrence, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rob McLean, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.